behind him, and the massive head bent towards his laird in eloquent witness. Colum sensed the movement and raised a hand briefly. "It's all right," the gesture said. "I'm all right for the present."
"No," Colum went on.
"I did not know you were in Edinburgh, in fact, until His Highness mentioned Jamie Fraser, and I asked."
A sudden smile grew on his face.
"His Highness isn't over fond of you, Mistress Clare, but I suppose you knew that."
I ignored this. "So you really are considering joining Prince Charles?" Colum, Dougal, and Jamie all had the capacity for hiding what they were thinking when they chose to. But of the three, Colum was undoubtedly best at it.
"You'd get more from one of the carved heads on the fountain in the front courtyard if he was feeling uncommunicative."
"I've come to see him," was all he said.
I sat a moment, wondering what, if anything, I could or should say in Charles's behalf. Perhaps I would do better to leave it to Jamie. After all, the fact that Colum felt regret over nearly killing me by accident didn't mean he was necessarily inclined to trust me. And while the fact that I was here, part of Charles's entourage, surely argued against my being an English spy, it wasn't impossible that I was. I was still debating with myself when Colum suddenly put down his glass of brandy and looked straight at me.
"Do you know how much of this I've had since morning?"
"No." His hands were steady, calloused and roughened from his disease, but well kept. The reddened lids and slightly bloodshot eyes could as easily be from the rigours of travel as from drink. There was no slurring of speech, and no more than a certain deliberateness of movement to indicate that he wasn't sober as a judge. But I had seen Colum drink before, and had a very respectful idea of his capacity. He waved away Angus Moore's hand hovering above the decanter.
"Half a bottle. I'll have it finished by tonight."
Ah. So that was why I had been asked to bring my medicine box. I reached for it, where I had set it on the floor.
"If you're needing that much brandy, there isn't much that will help you besides some form of opium," I said, flicking through my assortment of vials and jars.
"I think I have some laudanum here, but I can get you some..."
"That isn't what I want from you."
The tone of authority in his voice stopped me, and I looked up. If he could keep his thoughts to himself, he could also let them show when he chose.
"I could get laudanum easily enough," he said. "I imagine there's an apothecarist in the city who sells it, or poppy syrup, or undiluted opium, for that matter."
I let the lid of the small chest fall shut and rested my hands on top of it. So he didn't mean to waste away in a drugged state, leaving the leadership of the clan uncertain. And if it were not a temporary oblivion he sought from me, what else?
A permanent one, perhaps. I knew Colum Mackenzie, and the clear, ruthless mind that had planned Gillis Duncan's destruction wouldn't hesitate over his own.
Now it was clear. He had come to see Charles Stuart, to make the final decision whether to commit the Mackenzies of Leoch to the Jacobite cause. Once committed, it would be Dougal who led the clan. And then... "I was under the impression that suicide was considered a mortal sin," I said.
"I imagine it is," he said, undisturbed. "A sin of pride, at least, that I should choose a clean death at the time of my own devising, as best suits my purpose. I don't, however, expect to suffer unduly for my sin, having put no credence in the existence of God since I was 19 or so."
It was quiet in the room, beyond the crackle of the fire and the muffled shouts of mock battle from below. I could hear his breathing, a slow and steady sigh. "Why ask me?" I said.
"You're right. You could get laudanum where you liked, so long as you have money. And you do. Surely you know that enough of it will kill you. It's an easy death, at that."
"Too easy."
He shook his head.
"I have had little to depend on in life, save my wits. I would keep them, even to meet death, as for ease.
He shifted slightly on the sofa, making no effort to hide his discomfort.
I shall have enough presently.
He nodded toward my box.
You shared Mrs. Duncan's knowledge of medicines. I thought it possible that you knew what she used to kill her husband. That seemed quick and certain. And appropriate, he added wryly.
She used witchcraft, according to the verdict of the court. The court that condemned her to death in accordance with your plan, I thought.
Or do you not believe in witchcraft? I asked.
He laughed, a pure, carefree sound in the sunlit room.
A man who doesn't believe in God can scarce credit power to Satan, can he?
I still hesitated, but he was a man who judged others as shrewdly as he did himself. He had asked my pardon before asking my favour, and satisfied himself that I had a sense of justice, or of mercy. And it was, as he said, appropriate. I opened the box and took out the small vial of cyanide that I kept to kill rats.
"I thank ye, Mistress Clare," he said,
formal again, though the smile still lingered in his eyes.
"Had my nephew not proved your innocence with such flamboyance at Crane's Muir, still I would never believe you a witch. I have no more notion now than I had at our first meeting as to who you are or why you are here. But a witch is not one of the possibilities I've ever considered."
He paused, one brow raised.
"I don't suppose you'd be inclined to tell me who or what you are."
I hesitated for a moment. But a man with belief in neither God nor devil wasn't likely to believe the truth of my presence here, either. I squeezed his fingers lightly and released them. "Better call me a witch," I said. "It's as close as you're likely to get." On my way out to the courtyard next morning, I met Lord Balmerino on the stairs.
"Oh, Mistress Fraser," he greeted me jovially. "Just who I was looking for."
I smiled at him. A chubby, cheerful man, he was one of the refreshing features of life in Holyrood.
"If it isn't fever, flux, or French pox," I said, "can it wait for a moment? My husband and his uncle are giving a demonstration of Highland sword-fighting for the benefit of Don Francisco de la Quintana."
"Oh, really? I must say, I should like to see that myself."
Balmerino fell into step beside me, head bobbing cheerfully at the level of my shoulder.
"I do like a pretty man with a sword," he said. "And anything that will sweeten the Spaniards has my most devout approval."
Mine too. Deeming it too dangerous for Fergus to lift His Highness's correspondence inside Holyrood, Jamie was dependent for information on what he learned from Charles himself. This seemed to be quite a lot, though. Charles considered Jamie one of his intimates, virtually the only Highland chief to be accorded such a mark of favour, small as was his contribution in men and money. So far as money went, though, Charles had confided that he had high hopes of support from Philip of Spain, whose latest letter to James in Rome had been distinctly encouraging. Don Francisco, while not quite an envoy, was certainly a member of the Spanish court, and might be relied upon to carry back his report of how matters stood with the Stuart rising. This was Charles's opportunity to see how far his own belief in his destiny would carry him, in convincing Highland chiefs and foreign kings, to join him. "What did you want to see me for?" I asked, as we came out onto the walkway that edged the courtyard of Holyrood. A small crowd of spectators was assembling, but neither Don Francisco nor the two combatants were yet in sight.
"Oh!"
Reminded, Lord Balmerino groped inside his coat.
"Nothing of great importance, my dear lady. I received these from one of my messengers who obtained them from a kinsman to the south. I thought you might find them amusing."
He handed me a thin sheaf of crudely printed papers. I recognised them as broadsheets, the popular circulars distributed in taverns, or that fluttered from doorposts and hedges through towns and villages. "Charles Edward Stuart,"
known to all as the Young Pretender, read one. Be it known to all present that this depraved and dangerous person, having landed unlawfully upon the shores of Scotland, hath incited to riot the population of that country, and hath unleashed upon innocent citizens the fury of an unjust war.
There was quite a lot more of it, all in the same vein, concluding with an exhortation to the innocent citizens reading this indictment,
to do all in their power to deliver ye this person to the justice which he so richly deserves.
The sheet was decorated at the top with what I supposed was meant as a drawing of Charles. It didn't bear much resemblance to the original, but definitely looked depraved and dangerous, which I supposed was the general idea.
That one's quite fairly restrained, said Balmerino, peering over my elbow. Some of the others show a most impressive range both of imagination and invective, though. Look at this one. That's me, he said, pointing at the paper with evident delight.
The broadsheet showed a raw-boned Highlander, thickly bewhiskered, with beetling brows and eyes that glared wildly under the shadow of a Scotch bonnet. I looked askance at Lord Balmerino, clad, as was his habit, in breeches and coat in the best of taste, made of fine stuff, but subdued both in cut and colour, to flatter his tubby little form. He stared at the broadsheet, meditatively stroking his round, clean-shaven cheeks.
"I don't know," he said. "The whiskers do lend me a most romantic air, do they not? Still, a beard itches most infernally. I'm not sure I could bear it, even for the sake of being picturesque."
I turned to the next page and nearly dropped the whole sheaf.
"They did a slightly better job in rendering a likeness of your husband," Balmerino observed. "But of course our dear Jamie does actually look somewhat like the popular English conception of a Highland thug. Begging your pardon, my dear, I mean no offence. He is large, though, isn't he?"
"Yes," I said faintly, perusing the broadsheet's charges.
"Didn't realise your husband was in the habit of roasting and eating small children, did you?" said Balmerino, chortling. "I always thought his size was due to something special in his diet."
The little Earl's irreverent attitude did a good deal to steady me. I could almost smile myself at the ridiculous charges and descriptions, though I wondered just how much credence the readers of the broadsheets placed in them. Rather a lot, I was afraid. People so often seem not only willing but eager to believe the worst. And the worse, the better.
"It's the last one I thought you'd be interested in."
Balmerino interrupted my thoughts, flipping over the next to last sheet. "The Stuart Witch," proclaimed the heading. A long-nosed female with pinpoint pupils stared back at me, over a text which accused Charles Stuart of invoking "ye powers of darkness" in support of his unlawful cause. By retaining among his intimate entourage a well-known witch, one holding power of life and death over men, as well as the more usual power of blighting crops, drying up cattle, and causing blindness, Charles gave evidence of the fact that he had sold his own soul to the devil, and thus would "fry in hell for ever," as the tract gleefully concluded.
"I assume it must be you," Balmerino said, "though I assure you, my dear, the picture hardly does you justice."
"Very entertaining," I said. I gave the sheaf back to his lordship, restraining the urge to wipe my hand on my skirt. I felt a trifle ill, but did my best to smile at Balmerino. He glanced at me shrewdly, then took my elbow with a reassuring squeeze.
"Don't trouble yourself, my dear," he said. "Once His Majesty has regained his crown, all this nonsense will be forgotten in short order. Yesterday's villain is tomorrow's hero in the eyes of the populace. I've seen it time and time again."
"Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose," I murmured. "And if His Majesty King James didn't regain his crown?"
"And if our effort should by misfortune be unsuccessful,"
Balmerino said, echoing my thoughts,
"what the broadsheets say will be the least of our worries."
En garde.
With a formal French opening, Dougal fell into a classic dueller's stance, side on to his opponent, sword arm bent with the blade at the ready, back arm raised in a graceful arc, hand dropping from the wrist in open demonstration that no dagger was held in reserve. Jamie's blade crossed Dougal's, the metal meeting with a whisper of a clash.
Je suis prêt.
Jamie caught my eye and I could see the flicker of humour cross his face. The customary dueller's response was his own clan motto. Je suis prêt. I am ready. For a moment, I thought he might not be, and gasped involuntarily as Dougal's sword shot out in a lunging flash. But Jamie had seen the motion start, and by the time the blade crossed the place where he had been standing, he was no longer there. Sidestep, a quick beat of the blade, and a counter-lunge that brought the blades screeching together along their lengths. The two swords held fast together at the hilt for only a second, then the swordsman broke, stepped back, circled, and returned to the attack. With a clash and a beat, a parry and a lunge in tierce, Jamie came within an inch of Dougal's hip, swung adroitly aside with a flare of green kilt. A parry and a dodge and a quick upward beat that knocked the pressing blade aside, and Dougal stepped forward, forcing Jamie back a pace. I could see Don Francisco standing on the opposite side of the courtyard with Charles, Sheridan, the elderly Tully Barden, and a few others. A small smile curved the Spaniard's lips under a wisp of waxed moustache, but I couldn't tell whether it was admiration for the fighters or merely a variation on his normally supercilious expression. Corum was nowhere in sight. I wasn't surprised. Aside from his normal reluctance to appear in public, he must have been exhausted by the journey to Edinburgh. Both gifted swordsmen, and both left-handed, uncle and nephew were putting on a skilled display. A show made more impressive by the fact that they were fighting in accordance with the most exacting rules of French dueling, but using neither the rapier-like small sword that formed part of a gentleman's costume, nor the sabre of a soldier. Instead, both men wielded Highland broadswords, each a full yard of tempered steel with a flat blade that could cleave a man from crown to neck. They handled the enormous weapons with a grace and an irony that couldn't have been managed by smaller men. I saw Charles murmur in Don Francisco's ear, and the Spaniard nod, never taking his eyes off the flash and clang of the battle in the grass-lined court. Well matched in size and agility, Jamie and his uncle gave every appearance of intending to kill each other. Dougal had been Jamie's teacher in the art of swordsmanship, and they had fought back to back and shoulder to shoulder many times before. Each man knew the subtleties of the other's style as well as he knew his own, or at least I hoped so. Dougal pressed his advantage with a double lunge, forcing Jamie back toward the edge of the courtyard. Jamie stepped quickly to one side, struck Dougal's blade away with one beat, then slashed back the other way, with a speed that sent the blade of his broadsword through the cloth of Dougal's right sleeve. There was a loud ripping noise, and a strip of white linen hung free, fluttering in the breeze.
"Oh, nicely fought, sir."
I turned to see who had spoken, and found Lord Kilmarnock standing at my shoulder. A serious, plain-faced man in his early 30s, he and his young son Johnny were also housed in the guest quarters of Holyrood. The son was seldom far from his father, and I glanced around in search of him. I hadn't far to look. He was standing on the other side of his father, jaw slightly agape as he watched the sword play. My eye caught a faint movement from the far side of a pillar. Fergus, black eyes fixed unblinkingly on Johnny. I lowered my brows and glowered at him menacingly. Johnny, rather overconscious of being Kilmarnock's heir, and still more conscious of his privilege in going to war with his father at the age of 12, tended to lord it over the other lads. In the manner of lads, most of them either avoided Johnny or bided their time, waiting for him to step out of his father's protective shadow. Fergus most definitely fell into the latter group. Taking umbrage at a disparaging remark of Johnny's about bonnet lairds, which he had, quite accurately, interpreted as an insult to Jamie, Fergus had been forcibly prevented from assaulting Johnny in the rock garden a few days before. Jamie had administered swift justice on a physical level, and then pointed out to Fergus that while loyalty was an admirable virtue and highly prized by its recipient, stupidity was not.
"That lad is 2 years older than you, and 2 stone heavier," he had said, shaking Fergus gently by the shoulder. "Do you think you'll help me by getting your own head knocked in? There's times to fight without counting the cost, but there's times you bite your tongue and bide your time. Ne pétez plus haut que votre coule, hein?"
Fergus had nodded, wiping his tear-stained cheeks with the tail of his shirt. But I had my doubts as to whether Jamie's words had made much impression on him. I didn't like the speculative look I saw now in those wide black eyes, and thought that had Johnny been a trifle brighter, he would have been standing between me and his father. Jamie dropped halfway to one knee, with a murderous jab upward that brought his blade whizzing past Dougal's ear. The Mackenzie jerked back, looking startled for a moment, then grinned with a flash of white teeth, and banged his blade flat on top of Jamie's head with a resounding clong. I heard the sound of applause from across the square. The fight was degenerating from elegant French duel into Highland brawl, and the spectators were thoroughly enjoying the joke of it. Lord Kilmarnock, also hearing the sound, looked across the square and grimaced sourly. "His Highness's advisers are summoned to meet the Spaniard," he observed sarcastically. "O'Sullivan and that ancient fop, Tullibardine. Does he take advice of Lord Elcho, Balmerino, Lochiel, or even my humble self?" This was plainly a rhetorical question, and I contented myself with a faint murmur of sympathy, keeping my eyes on the fighters. The clash of steel rang off the stones, nearly drowning out Kilmarnock's words. Once having started, though, he seemed unable to contain his bitterness.
"No, indeed," he said. "O'Sullivan and O'Brien and the rest of the Irish, they risk nothing. If the worst should ever happen, they can plead immunity from prosecution by reason of their nationality. But we who are risking property, honour, life itself, we are ignored and treated like common dragoons. I said good morning to His Highness yesterday, and he swept by me, nose in the air, as though I'd committed a breach in etiquette by so addressing him."
Kilmarnock was plainly furious, and with good reason. Ignoring the men whom he had charmed and courted into providing the men and money for his adventure, Charles then had rejected them, turning to the comfort of his old advisers from the Continent, most of whom regarded Scotland as a howling wilderness, and its inhabitants as little more than savages. There was a whoop of surprise from Dougal, and a wild laugh from Jamie. Dougal's left sleeve hung free from the shoulder, the flesh beneath brown and smooth, unmarred by a scratch or a drop of blood.
"I'll pay ye for that weed, Jamie," Dougal said, grinning. Droplets of sweat ran down his face. "Will ye, uncle?" Jamie panted. "With what?"
A flash of metal judged to a nicety, and Dougal's sporran flew jingling across the stones, clipped free from the belt. I caught a movement from the corner of my eye and turned my head sharply.
"Fergus," I said.
Kilmarnock turned in the direction I was looking, and saw Fergus. The boy carried a large stick in one hand, with a casualness so assumed as to be laughable, if it weren't for the implicit threat.
"Don't trouble yourself, my Lady Brochturach," said Lord Kilmarnock, after a brief glance. "You may depend upon my son to defend himself honourably, if the occasion demands it."
He beamed indulgently at Johnny, then turned back to the swordsman. I turned back too, but kept an ear cocked in Johnny's direction. It wasn't that I thought Fergus lacked a sense of honour. I just had the impression that it diverged rather sharply from Lord Kilmarnock's notion of that virtue.
"Golio!"
At the cry from Dougal, the fight stopped abruptly. Sweating freely, both swordsmen bowed toward the applause of the royal party and stepped forward to accept congratulations and be introduced to Don Francisco.
"Milor," called a high voice from the pillars. "Please, le parabole."
Jamie turned half frowning at the interruption, but then shrugged, smiled, and stepped back into the centre of the courtyard. Le parabole was the name Fergus had given this particular trick. With a quick bow to His Highness, Jamie took the broadsword carefully by the tip of the blade, stooped slightly, and with a tremendous heave sent the blade whirling straight up into the air. Every eye fixed on the basket-hilted sword, the tempered length of it glinting in the sun as it turned end over end over end, with such inertia that it seemed to hang in the air for a moment before plunging earthward. The essence of the trick, of course, was to hurl the weapon so that it buried itself point first in the earth as it came down. Jamie's refinement of this was to stand directly under the arc of descent, stepping back at the last moment to avoid being skewered by the falling blade. The sword chunked home at his feet to the accompaniment of a collective "Ah!" from the spectators. It was only as Jamie bent to pull the sword from its grassy sheath that I noticed the ranks of the spectators had been reduced by two. One, the 12-year-old master of Kilmarnock, lay face down on the grassy verge, the swelling bump on his head already apparent through the lank brown hair. The second was nowhere visible, but I caught a faint whisper from the shadows behind me.
"Ne pétez plus haut que votre cul," it said with satisfaction.
"Don't fart above your asshole." The weather was unseasonably warm for November, and the omnipresent clouds had broken, letting a fugitive autumn sun shine briefly on the greyness of Edinburgh. I had taken advantage of the transient warmth to be outside, however briefly, and was crawling on my knees through the rock garden behind Holyrood, much to the amusement of several Highlanders hanging about the grounds, enjoying the sunshine in their own manner, with a jug of home-brewed whisky.
"At hunting burrus, mistress," called one man. "Nay, it'll be fairies, surely, not caterpillars," joked another.
"You're more likely to find fairies in that jug than I am under rocks," I called back. The man held the jug up, closed one eye, and squinted theatrically into its depths.
"Aye, well, so long as there isn't a caterpillars in my jug," he replied, and took a deep swig.
In fact, what I was hunting would make as little or as much sense to them as caterpillars, I reflected, shoving one boulder a few inches to the side to expose the orange-brown lichen on its surface. A delicate scraping with a small penknife, and several flakes of the odd symbiont fell into my palm to be transferred with due care to the cheap tin snuff-box that held my painfully acquired hoard. Something of the relatively cosmopolitan attitude of Edinburgh had rubbed off on the visiting Highlanders. While in the remote mountain villages such behaviour would have gotten me viewed with suspicion, if not downright hostility, here it seemed no more than a harmless quirk. While the Highlanders treated me with great respect, I was relieved to find that there was no fear mingled with it. Even my basic Englishness was forgiven, once it was known who my husband was. I supposed I was never going to know more than Jamie had told me about what he had done at the Battle of Prestonpans, but whatever it was, it had mightily impressed the Scots, and Red Jamie drew shouts and hails whenever he ventured outside Holyrood. In fact, a shout from the nearby Highlanders drew my attention at this point, and I looked up to see Red Jamie himself strolling across the grass, waving absently to the men as he scanned the serried rocks behind the palace. His face lightened as he saw me, and he came across the grass to where I knelt in the rockery.
"There you are," he said. "Can you come with me for a bit, and bring your wee basket along, if you will?"
I scrambled to my feet, dusting the dried grass from the knees of my gown and dropping my scraping knife into the basket.
"All right. Where are we going?"
"Collum's sent word he wishes to speak with us. Both of us."
"Where?"
I asked, stretching my steps to keep up with his long stride down the path.
"The kirk," can the cannon eat.
This was interesting. Whatever Colin wished to see us about, he clearly didn't want the fact that he had spoken with us privately to be known in Holyrood. Neither did Jamie, hence the basket. Passing arm in arm through the gate, my basket gave an apparent excuse for our venturing up the Royal Mile, whether it were to convey purchases home or distribute medicines to the men and their families quartered in the wynds and closes of Edinburgh. Edinburgh sloped upward steeply along its one main street. Holyrood sat in dignity at the foot, the creaking abbey vault alongside conferring a spurious air of gracious security. It loftily ignored the glowering presence of Edinburgh Castle, perched high on the crest of the rocky hill above. In between the two castles, the Royal Mile rose at a rough angle of 45 degrees. Puffing red-faced at Jamie's side, I wondered how in hell Colum Mackenzie had ever negotiated the quarter mile of cobbled slope from the palace to the kirk. We found Colum in the kirkyard, sitting on a stone bench where the late afternoon sun could warm his back. His blackthorn stick lay on the bench beside him, and his short, bowed legs dangled a few inches above the ground. Shoulders hunched and head bowed in thought, at a distance he looked like a gnome, a natural inhabitant of this man-made rock garden with its tilted stones and creeping lichens. I eyed a prime specimen on a weathered vault, but supposed we had better not stop. The grass was soundless under our feet, but Colum raised his head while we were still some distance away. There was nothing wrong with his senses, at least. The shadow under a nearby lime tree moved slightly at our approach. There was nothing wrong with Angus Moore's senses, either. Satisfied of our identity, the big servant resumed his silent guardianship, becoming again part of the landscape. Colum nodded in greeting and motioned to the seat beside him. Near at hand, there was no suggestion of the gnomish, despite his twisted body. Face to face, you saw nothing but the man within. Jamie found me a seat on a nearby stone before taking up the place indicated next to Colum. The marble was surprisingly cold, even through my thick skirts, and I shifted a bit, the carved skull and crossbones atop the memorial lumpy and uncomfortable underneath me. I saw the epitaph carved below it and grinned. "Here lies Martin Elginbrod. Have mercy on my soul, Lord God, as I would do were I Lord God, and thou wert Martin Elginbrod." Jamie raised one brow at me in warning, then turned back to Colum. "You asked to see us, Uncle."
"Have a question for you, Jamie Fraser," Colum said without preamble. "Do you hold me as your kinsman?"
Jamie was silent for a moment, studying his uncle's face. Then he smiled faintly.
"You've my mother's eyes," he said. "Shall I deny that?"
Colum looked startled for a moment. His eyes were the clear, soft grey of a dove's wing, fringed thick with black lashes. For all their beauty, they could gleam cold as steel, and I wondered, not for the first time, just what Jamie's mother had been like.
"You remember your mother? You knew more than a wee laddie when she died."
Jamie's mouth twisted slightly at this, but he answered calmly.
"Old enough. For that matter, my father's house had a looking-glass. I'm told I favour her a bit."
Colum laughed shortly.
"More than a bit."
He peered closely at Jamie, eyes squinting slightly in the bright sun.
"Oh, aye, lad, you're Ellen's son. Not a doubt of it. That hair, for the one thing."
He gestured vaguely toward Jamie's hair, glinting auburn and amber, roan and cinnabar, a thick wavy mass with a thousand colours of red and gold.
"And that mouth."
Colum's own mouth rose at one side, as though in reluctant reminiscence.
"Wide as a nightjar, as I used to tease her. You could catch bugs like a toad, I'd say to her, had you no but a sticky tongue."
Taken by surprise, Jamie laughed.
"Willie said that once to me," he said, and then the full lips clamped shut.
He spoke rarely of his dead elder brother, and never, I imagined, had he mentioned Willie to Colum before.
If Colum noticed the slip, he gave no sign of it.
"I wrote to her then," he said, looking abstractedly at one of the tilted stones nearby. "When your brother and the babe died of the pox. That was the first time since she left Leoch."
"Since she wed my father, you mean?"
Colum nodded slowly, still looking away.
"Aye. She was older than me again, by 2 years or so, about the same as between your sister and you."
The deep-set grey eyes swiveled back and fixed on Jamie.
"I've never met your sister. Were you close, the two of you?"
Jamie didn't speak, but nodded slightly, studying his uncle closely, as though looking for the answer to a puzzle in the worn face before him. Colum nodded, too.
"It was that way between Ellen and myself. I was a sickly wee thing, and she nursed me often. I remember the sun shining through her hair, and she telling me tales as I lay in bed. Even later..."
The fine-cut lips lifted in a slight smile.
"When my legs first gave way, she'd come and go all about Leoch and stop each morning and night in my chamber to tell me who'd she'd seen and what they'd said. We'd talk about the tenants and the taxmen and how things might be arranged. I was married then, but Letitia had no mind for such matters and less interest."
He flipped a hand, dismissing his wife.
"We talked between us, sometimes with Dougal, sometimes alone, of how the fortunes of the clan might best be maintained, how peace might be kept among the septs, which alliances could be made with other clans, how the lands and the timber should be managed. And then she left," he said abruptly,
looking down at the broad hands folded on his knee,
"with no asking of leave nor word of farewell. She was gone. And I heard of her from others now and then, but from herself, nothing."
"She didn't answer your letter?" I asked softly, not wanting to intrude. He shook his head, still looking down.
"She was ill. She lost a child as well as having the pox. And perhaps she meant to write later. It's an easy task to put off."
He smiled briefly without humour, and then his face relaxed into somberness.
"But by Christmas 12th, she was dead."
He looked directly at Jamie, who met his gaze squarely.
"I was a bit surprised then when your father wrote to tell me he was taking you to Dougal, and wished you then to come to me at Leoch for your schooling."
"That was agreed so when they wed," Jamie answered, "that I should foster with Dougal, and then come to you for a time."
The dry twigs of a larch rattled in a passing wind, and he and Colum both hunched their shoulders against the sudden chill of it, their family resemblance exaggerated by the similarity of the gesture. Colum saw my smile at their resemblance. One corner of his mouth turned up in answer.
"Oh, aye," he said to Jamie. "But agreements are worth as much as the men who make them, and nae more. And I didna know your father then."
He opened his mouth to go on, but then seemed to reconsider what he had been about to say. The silence of the kirkyard flowed back into the space their conversation had made, filling in the gap as though no word were ever spoken. It was Jamie, finally, who broke the silence once more.
"What did you think of my father?" he asked.
And I glimpsed in his tone that curiosity of a child who has lost his parents early, seeking clues to the identity of these people, known only from a child's restricted point of view. I understood the impulse. What little I knew of my own parents came almost entirely from Uncle Lamb's brief and unsatisfactory answers to my questions. He wasn't a man given to character analysis. Colum, on the other hand, was.
"What was he like, do you mean?"
He looked his nephew over carefully, then gave a short grunt of amusement.
"Look ye in the mirror, lad," he said, a half-grudging smile lingering on his face. "If it's your mother's face you see, it's your father looking back at you through those damned Fraser cat eyes."
He stretched and shifted his position, easing his bones on the lichened stone bench.
His lips were pressed tight by habit against any exclamation of discomfort, and I could see what had made those deep creases between nose and mouth.
"To answer you, though," he went on, once more comfortably settled, "I didn't like the man over much, nor he me. But I knew him at once for a man of honour."
He paused, then said very softly,
"I know you for the same, Jamie Mackenzie Fraser."
Jamie didn't change expression, but there was a faint quiver to his eyelids. Only one as familiar with him as I was, or as observant as Colm was, would have noticed. Colm let out his breath in a long sigh.
"So, lad, that's why I wish to talk with you. I must decide, you see, whether the Mackenzies of Leoch go for King James or King Geordie."
He smiled sourly.
"It's a case, I think, of the devil you know or the devil you don't, but it's a choice I must make."
"Dougal," Jamie began, but his uncle cut him off with a sharp motion of his hand.
"Aye, I know what Dougal thinks. I've had little rest from it these 2 years past," he said impatiently. "But I am the Mackenzie of Leoch, and it's mine to decide. Dougal will abide by what I say. I'd know what you'd advise me to do, for the sake of the clan whose blood runs in your veins."
Jamie glanced up, eyes dark blue and impervious, hooded against the afternoon sun that shone in his face.
"I am here, and my men with me," he said. "Surely my choice is plain."
Colm shifted himself again, head cocked attentively to his nephew, as though to catch any nuances of voice or expression that might give him a clue.
"Is it?" he asked. "Men give their allegiance for any number of reasons, lad, and few of them have much to do with the reasons they speak aloud. I've talked with Lochiel and Clan Ranald and Angus and Alex MacDonald of Scotus. Do you think they're here only because they feel James Stuart their rightful king? Now, I would talk with you, and hear the truth for the sake of your father's honour."
Seeing Jamie hesitate, Colm went on, still watching his nephew keenly.
"I don't ask for myself. If you've eyes, you can see that the matter isn't one that will trouble me long. But for Hamish, the lad is your cousin, remember. If there's to be a clan for him to lead once he's of age, then I must choose rightly now."
He stopped speaking and sat still, the usual caution now relaxed from his features, the grey eyes open and listening. Jamie sat as still as Colm, frozen like the marble angel on the tomb behind him. I knew the dilemma that preoccupied him, though no trace of it showed on the stern, chiselled face. It was the same one we had faced before, choosing to come with the men from Lallybroch. Charles Rising was balanced on a knife-edge. The allegiance of a large clan, such as the Mackenzies of Leoch, might encourage others to join the brash young pretender and lead to his success. But if it ended in failure nonetheless, the Mackenzies of Leoch could well end with it. At last Jamie turned his head deliberately and looked at me, blue eyes holding my own.
"You have some say in this," his look said. "What shall I do?"
I could feel Colm's eyes upon me too, and felt, rather than saw, the questioning lift of the thick dark brows above them. But what I saw in my mind's eye was young Hamish, a red-headed 10-year-old, who looked enough like Jamie to be his son rather than his cousin. And what life might be for him and the rest of his clan if the Mackenzies of Leoch fell with Charles at Culloden. The men of Lallybroch had Jamie to save them from final slaughter, if it came to that. The men of Leoch would not. And yet the choice couldn't be mine. I shrugged and bowed my head. Jamie took a deep breath and made up his mind.
"Go home to Leoch, uncle," he said, "and keep your men there."
Colm sat motionless for a long minute, looking straight at me. Finally, his mouth curled upward, but the expression wasn't quite a smile.
"I nearly stopped Ned Gowan when he went to keep you from burning," he said to me. "I suppose I'm glad I didn't."
"Thanks," I said, my tone matching his. He sighed, rubbing the back of his neck with a calloused hand, as though it ached under the weight of leadership.
"Well, then, I shall see His Highness in the morning and tell him my decision."
The hand descended, lying inert on the stone bench, halfway between him and his nephew.
"I thank you, Jamie, for your advice."
He hesitated, then added,
"And may God go with you."
Jamie leaned forward and laid his hand over Colum's. He smiled his mother's wide, sweet smile and said,
"And with you too, Mokarash."
The Royal Mile was busy, thronged with people taking advantage of the brief hours of warmth. We walked in silence through the crowd, my hand tucked deep into the crook of Jamie's elbow. Finally, he shook his head, muttering something to himself in Gaelic. "You did right," I said to him, answering the thought rather than the words. "I would have done the same. Whatever happens, at least the Mackenzies will be safe."
"Aye, perhaps."
He nodded to a greeting from a passing officer, jostling through the crowd that surrounded the World's End.
"But what of the rest, the MacDonalds and the McGilveries and the others that have come? Will they be destroyed now, where maybe they wouldn't, had I had the nerve to tell Colum to join them?"
He shook his head, face clouded.
"There's no knowing, is there, Sassenach?"
"No," I said softly, squeezing his arm. "Never enough, or maybe too much. But we can't do nothing on that account, surely." He gave me a half-smile back and pressed my hand against his side.
"No, Sassenach, I dinna suppose we can. And it's done now, and naught can change it, so it's no good worrying. The Mackenzies will stay out of it."
The sentry at the gate of Holyrood was a MacDonald, one of Glengarry's men. He recognised Jamie and nodded us into the courtyard, barely looking up from his louse-searching. The warm weather made the vermin active, and as they left their cosy nests in crotch and armpit, often they could be surprised while crossing the perilous terrain of shirt or tartan and removed from the body of their host. Jamie said something to him in Gaelic, smiling. The man laughed, picked something from his shirt, and flicked it at Jamie, who pretended to catch it, eyed the imaginary beastie critically, then, with a wink at me, popped it into his mouth. "How's your son's head, Lord Kilmarnock?" I inquired politely as we stepped out together onto the floor of Holyrood's great gallery. I didn't care greatly, but I thought, as the topic couldn't be avoided altogether, it was perhaps better to air it in a place where hostility was unlikely to be openly exhibited. The gallery met that criterion, I thought. The long, high-ceiled room, with its two vast fireplaces and towering windows, had been the scene of frequent balls and parties since Charles' triumphant entry into Edinburgh in September. Now, crowded with the luminaries of Edinburgh's upper class, all anxious to do honour to their prince, once it appeared that he might actually win, the room positively glittered. Don Francisco, the guest of honour, stood at the far end of the room with Charles, dressed in the depressing Spanish style, with baggy dark pantaloons, shapeless coat, and even a small ruff, which seemed to provoke considerable suppressed amusement among the younger and more fashionable element.
"Oh, well enough, Mistress Fraser," replied Kilmarnock, imperturbably. "A dunt on the skull will not discommode a lad of that age for long. Though his pride may take a bit more mending," he added, with a sudden humorous twist to his long mouth.
I smiled at him, relieved to see it.
"You're not angry?"
He shook his head, looking down to be sure that his feet were clear of my sweeping skirt.
"I have tried to teach John the things he should know as heir to Kilmarnock. In teaching him humility, I seem to have signally failed. Perhaps your servant may have had more success.
I suppose you didn't whack him outside, I said absently.
Pardon?
Nothing, I said, flushing. Look, is that Lochiel? I thought he was ill.
Dancing required most of my breath, and Lord Kilmarnock appeared not to wish for conversation, so I had time to look around. Charles wasn't dancing, though he was a good dancer, and the young women of Edinburgh vied for his attentions. Tonight he was thoroughly engrossed in the entertainment of his guest. I had seen a small cask with a Portuguese brand mark burned into its side being rolled into the kitchen in the afternoon, and glasses of the ruby liquid kept reappearing by Don Francisco's left hand as though by magic through the evening. We crossed the path of Jamie, propelling one of the Mrs. Williams through the figures of the dance. There were three of them, nearly indistinguishable from one another, young, brown-haired, comely, and all so terribly interested, Mr. Freezer, in this noble cause. They made me quite tired, but Jamie, ever the soul of patience, danced with them all, one by one, and answered the same silly questions over and over.
"Well, that's a change for them to get out, poor things," he explained kindly. "Their father's a rich merchant, so His Highness would like to encourage the sympathy of the family."
The Miss Williams with him looked enthralled, and I wondered darkly just how encouraging he was being. Then my attention shifted as Balmerino danced by with Lord George Murray's wife. I saw the Murrays exchange affectionate glances as they passed, he with another of the Mrs. Williams, and felt mildly ashamed of my noticing who Jamie danced with. Not surprisingly, Colum wasn't at the ball. I wondered whether he had had a chance to speak to Charles beforehand, but decided probably not. Charles looked much too cheerful and animated to have been the recipient of bad news any time recently. At one side of the gallery, I caught sight of two stocky figures, almost identical in uncomfortable and unaccustomed formal dress. It was John Simpson, Master of the Swordsmakers Guild of Glasgow, and his son, also John Simpson. Arrived earlier in the week to present His Highness with one of the magnificent basket-hilted broadswords for which they were famed throughout Scotland, the two artisans had plainly been invited tonight to show Don Francisco the depth of support that the Stuarts enjoyed. Both men had thick, dark hair and beards lightly frosted with grey. Simpson Senior was salt with a sprinkle of pepper, while Simpson Junior gave the impression of a dark hillside with a rim of snow crusted lightly round its frost line, white hairs confined to the temples and upper cheeks. As I watched, the older sword maker poked his son sharply in the back and nodded with significance toward one of the merchant's daughters, hovering near the edge of the floor under her father's protection. Simpson Jr. gave his father a sceptical glance, but then shrugged, stepped out, and offered his arm with a bow to the third Miss Williams. I watched with amusement and fascination as they whirled out into the steps of the dance, for Jamie, who had met the Simpsons earlier, had told me that Simpson Jr. was quite deaf.
"From all the hammering at the forge, I should think," he had said, showing me with pride the beautiful sword he had bought from the artisans. "Deaf as a stone. His father does the talking, but the young one sees everything."
I saw the sharp dark eyes flick rapidly across the floor now, judging to a nicety the distance from one couple to the next. The young swordmaster trod a little heavily, but kept the measure of the dance well enough, at least as well as I did. Closing my eyes, I felt the thrum of the music vibrating through the wooden floor from the cellos resting on it, and assumed that was what he followed. Then, opening my eyes so as not to crash into anyone, I saw Junior wince at a screeching miscue among the violins. Perhaps he did hear some sounds then. The circling of the dancers brought Kilmarnock and myself close to the place where Charles and Don Francisco stood, warming their coat-tails before the huge tile-lined fireplace. To my surprise, Charles scowled at me over Don Francisco's shoulder, motioning me away with a surreptitious movement of one hand. Seeing it as we turned, Kilmarnock gave a short laugh.
"So His Highness is afraid to have you introduced to the Spaniard," he said.
"Really?"
I looked back over my shoulder as we whirled away, but Charles had returned to his conversation, waving his hands with expressive Italian gestures as he talked.
"I expect so."
Lord Kilmarnock danced skilfully, and I was beginning to relax enough to be able to speak, without worrying incessantly about tripping over my skirts.
"Did you see that silly broadsheet Balmerino was showing everyone?"
he asked. And when I nodded, went on,
"I imagine His Highness saw it too. The Spanish are sufficiently superstitious to be ridiculously sensitive to idiocies of that sort. No person of sense or breeding could take such a thing seriously,"
he assured me.
"But no doubt His Highness thinks it best to be safe. Spanish gold is worth a considerable sacrifice, after all," he added.
Apparently including the sacrifice of his own pride. Charles still treated the Scottish earls and the Highland chieftains like beggars at his table, though they had at least been invited to the festivities tonight, no doubt to impress Don Francisco. "Have you noticed the pictures?" I asked, wanting to change the subject. There were more than 100 of them lining the walls of the great gallery, all portraits, all of kings and queens, and all with a most striking similarity.
"Oh, the news," he said,
an amused smile replacing the grim expression that had taken possession of his face at sight of Charles and the Spaniard.
"Yes, of course. Do you know the story behind it?"
The portraits, it seemed, were all the work of a single painter, one Jacob de Witt, who had been commissioned by Charles II, upon that worthy's restoration, to produce portraits of all the king's ancestors from the time of Robert the Bruce onward.
"To assure everyone of the ancientness of his lineage and the entire appropriateness of his restoration," Kilmarnock explained,
a wry twist to his mouth.
"I wonder if King James will undertake a similar project when he regains the throne." "In any case," he continued, "De Witt had painted furiously, completing one portrait every 2 weeks in order to comply with the monarch's demand. The difficulty, of course, was that De Witt had no way of knowing what Charles' ancestors had actually looked like, and had therefore used as sitters anyone he could drag into his studio, merely equipping each portrait with the same prominent nose by way of ensuring a family resemblance."
"That's King Charles himself," Kilmarnock said, nodding at a full-length portrait, resplendent in red velvet and plumed hat. He cast a critical glance at the younger Charles, whose flushed face gave evidence that he had been hospitably keeping his guests company in his potations.
"Better news, anyway," the Earl murmured, as though to himself. "His mother was Polish."
It was growing late, and the candles in the silver candelabra were beginning to gutter and go out before the gentlefolk of Edinburgh had had their fill of wine and dancing. Don Francisco, possibly not as accustomed as Charles to unrestrained drinking, was nodding into his ruff. Jamie, having with an obvious expression of relief restored the last Miss Williams to her father for the journey home, came to join me in the corner where I had found a seat that enabled me to slip off my shoes under cover of my spreading skirts. I hoped I wouldn't have to put them on again in a hurry. Jamie sat down on a vacant seat beside me, mopping his glowing face with a large white handkerchief. He reached past me to the small table, where a tray with a few leftover cakes was sitting.
"I'm fair starved," he said. "Dancing gives you a terrible appetite, and the talking's worse."
He popped a whole cake into his mouth at once, chewed it briefly, and reached for another. I saw Prince Charles bend over the slumped form of the guest of honour and shake him by the shoulder, to little effect. The Spanish envoy's head was fallen back, and his mouth was slack beneath the drooping moustache. His Highness stood rather unsteadily, and glanced about for help. But Sheridan and Tully Bardon, both elderly gentlemen, had fallen asleep themselves, leaning companionably together like a couple of old village sots in lace and velvet.
"Maybe you'd better give His Highness a hand," I suggested.
"Mm-hmm."
Resigned. Jamie swallowed the rest of his cake. But before he could rise, I saw the younger Simpson, who had taken quick note of the situation,